Member-supported Jazz 90.1 proudly welcomes you to America's longest-running computer show, Soundbites. Call the show now at 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll-free 800-790-0415 or soundbites.org. Now, alongside Steve Ray and Dave Enright, here's Nick Francesco on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Good afternoon, Mr. and Mrs. Merrick and all the gyps in the BC. It is Saturday, the 12th day of 2019. And you, you lucky people, you're listening to Soundbites. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 6 minutes after the hour, we are going to be bringing you news, views, things to choose, nothing to lose. Kick off your shoes. Don't get the blues. Here comes the news. The Consumer Electronics Show, CES, is over for 2019. While it would take much longer than we have today to list everything that was announced, here are a few highlights. Google announced that by the end of January, it expects Google Assistant to be available on 1 billion with a B devices, which leaves Amazon's device count in the dust. They also announced more features for Google Assistant, including integration into Google Maps and how it will help you check into your airline flight. Android will let you use Google Assistant to respond to text messages on your phone via SMS, WhatsApp Messenger, Hangouts, Viber, Telegram, Android Messages, and more. Android phones will soon get an update that will allow people to set their phones so they can access features on Google Assistant without having to go out of the lock screen, which includes search results, setting up alarms, and more. LG announced their LG Signature OLED TV R, a TV with a rollable OLED display that rolls up inside the stand when you're not watching.
I've always thought rollable is easier than foldable.
Yeah, exactly. They also announced its new TV will support AirPlay 2 and Apple HomeKit, which was kind of a running theme for TV makers at CES 2019, as well as a slew of other announcements related to TV tech, including 11 new OLED or LCD models. LG showcased its new smart alert system for home appliances and a smart beer maker. No, really. It's called the LG Homebrew, and it sounds awesome. Samsung showed off a 75-inch modular micro-LED TV and a whopping 98-inch QLED 8K TV. You have to live in a stadium in order to put it far enough away to see. New smart fridges and robots will also debut at the show, as well as the Notebook 9 Pen and a brand-new Odyssey gaming laptop. Samsung also said that its Bixby Assistant will soon be able to control Google Apps. Two people found that interesting. Lenovo introduced a bunch of laptops, a bedside clock with Google Assistant, Android tablets, and a 27-inch all-in-one desktop computer. Sony revealed its first 8K TV set, some new 4K TVs, and a whole bunch of audio products. HTC's Vive brand delivered two new virtual reality headsets, the Vive Pro I and the Vive Cosmos. Intel's press conference centered on the new Ice Lake laptop chips. The mobile chip range is Intel's first volume 10-nanometer PC processor for thin laptops, which should provide better battery life and less thermal-induced throttling. Lots of new Chromebooks were introduced from Acer, HP, and Asus, among others. Security gadgets, smart cars, phones, watches. It's going to be an interesting year. So our poll of the week at soundbites.org, that is Bites with a Y, Francis would like to remind you, is CES 2019. And your choices are, I want everything. I saw a few things I'd like, and nothing really grabbed me. So far we've got 23 people who voted, and nothing really grabbed me. Seems to be significantly in the lead. Now I know you'll have more to say about this. So if you scroll down on the right under Fascinating Stuff, you'll see the forums. The second forum down is the poll discussion. Currently, at least, the first item under poll discussion is 12 Jan 19, CES 2019. Join us in the discussion there. And, of course, you can join us here. Give us a call at 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free at 1-800-790-0415.
There were a lot of robots were a very popular theme this year.
Yeah.
Including some personal robots, like the little, was it Meebo that was big? And apparently there was a really personal robot
there were several of those
that had to get banned from demonstrations.
Yep.
And
yep.
Turn the booth around type thing.
Yep. But the CES is when people, it's the big show now. There aren't a lot. There used to be, you know, PC, two or three PC expos a year and a bunch of others. But now the big one seems to be CES, and everybody shows off their stuff. There was an amazing amount of new tech that was on display, but most of it was the same old tech in new boxes. You know, new wine in old jars, essentially. Mm-hmm. Or old wine in new jars, I guess. But there wasn't, you know, there weren't breakthroughs. And that's been a problem for quite a few years. We get bigger screens, we get thinner devices, we get, somebody's assistant plugged into something, but that's it. There hasn't been any wow technology, you know, there's no iPod.
No, you know? Ooh or ah factor.
Right. The thing that just makes people sit up and take notice.
Yeah, or they got to be at, you know, 12 o'clock at night standing in line so they're the first one to go in and get it.
Yeah, the 98-inch TV for people that really like sitting in the front row of a giant movie screen.
Yeah, right. Or you live in a barn.
Yeah.
And you can put it on that back wall.
Well, and so we were talking about the rolling TV at the shop today, and people, you know, the young kids, yeah, there.
To be clear, it rolls up like a window shade.
Right.
Well, from the bottom, but still, it rolls up, or like those pull down maps that I had in my childhood.
Well, yeah, and that's a point I was trying to get to. So, sorry. Yeah. The kids at the office were too young to remember. Yeah, 10 years ago. 10 years ago, it was really common to have projection screens in your home theater because
big TVs
were too expensive. So you'd have a screen roll down out of the ceiling,
right?
Usually covering a window because you didn't have a room for your home theater. And why would you want your TV to roll away so it's not there when you're not using it? I guess it's such a foreign concept that you wouldn't be using your TV.
Right.
They just didn't think of it that way.
When would I ever put it away? Right.
Yeah.
No, I get that. That was the idea behind Murphy beds and behind
there's an old technology
entertainment cabinets,
yep.
Right, where you could, if you had oddly, if you were entertaining, you could close up the entertainment cabinet and not have a TV staring at people. And now, of course, people get together to watch TV.
Yeah, back when TVs were furniture, you know, beautiful wood furniture, and so you had this giant cabinet, looked like a china cabinet or something, and it would hide that ugly TV when you weren't using it, which was most of the time.
Right.
When you watch TV 2 or 3 hours a night, only.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And now, of course, TVs are the centerpiece of the room in a lot of cases.
Yeah.
Or if you have a TV at all, a lot of kids particularly are watching stuff on their phones all the time, or maybe their tablets, but usually their phones.
Or a computer monitor is now a streaming media device.
Right, right, of some sort, right.
We see a lot of especially younger kids that don't have a traditional cable TV service. They do everything streaming. They don't have a traditional television. They just have a giant gaming monitor.
Right. Well, my daughter's home from Arizona, which is wonderful. But I got a little notice on my phone last night. Someone is streaming Hulu. Okay, so let me get this straight. Instead of turning on the TV, opening up the Roku box, and opening up Hulu, you turned on the TV, started your phone. Are you okay? Can we go on, or do you need to interrupt?
No, I'm laughing at you.
All right, thank you. Instead of turning on the TV and watching it on the Roku, she turns it on, then turns on her phone, then opens up Hulu on her phone, then casts it to the television so she can sit there and watch it. But that's how she does stuff.
Yep.
You know, she doesn't need Roku at home. She doesn't need any of those things because she does it all off her phone. So if she's at home, she casts it to a bigger screen. And if she's not, she just leaves it on her phone and watches because she's young and she's got good eyes. And that's all fine. It's just it's a whole different way of thinking and looking at things and understanding the way the world works. And so CES is kind of in between. I mean, let's face it, most of the people who are designing products are 30 and 40 years old, which means they're not doing that kind of stuff. So it's a very different world.
I have to laugh because, like I say, you know, she's gone, and then all of a sudden she comes in, and you know, doing all this technology. And you wonder, she's just a byproduct of you.
Yeah, she really is.
She is. I mean, you've taught her well, my friend. You've taught her well. That's why I have to laugh.
Although she did say, oh, this is bad, Dad. I said, what? She said, I can get used to this kind of internet speed real fast.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's right. Yep. She doesn't have the high speed out there?
Right. Well, she's got a decent speed.
It's only 100.
Oh, yeah. 100 megabits, yeah. Oh. Sad. But, yeah, so... she's home and she's happily doing whatever she does. But you know, that's her. That's the way she thinks now. That's her. Mm-hmm. It's a reflex. When you're going to watch something, mm-hmm. when you want entertainment, you grab your phone.
Yep.
That's how they do it. And that's why there was, for example, some small company that I've never heard of and can't remember the name off the top of my head, has a foldable phone. It folds into thirds. So when you open it out, it's like a tablet. Mm-hmm. But you fold both wings in, and it becomes a phone-sized device. And they say it's not particularly good, but they were first to market, and that's something, I suppose.
Yeah.
But there's lots of, like I said, Google is in a billion products. Amazon's Echo technology, which I will call Alaska. Thank you, Dennis Worster. So that I don't set off a million of them out there. The Alaska products are all over the place. So if you take a look at any of the announcements from CES, you'll find everything from clocks to cars to bicycles to shoes to everything has one of the smart assistants in it. And it's the future. It's what we're going to do next.
Yeah, I mean, that's the way it is. Well, as I've said before, you know, you can go into most stores now, you know, these like Best Buy's or any of these other stores. And back in the day, there'd be all these different desktops.
Yep.
Now you don't see it. You either see laptops, tablets, and because that's the way it is right now. Everybody's usually a tablet or a laptop. The bigger boxes aren't as prevalent as they used to be.
Right.
And neither company, PC or Mac side, are coming out with it. It's all the Chromebooks and, Mac software and the regular Windows. I mean, you got those three choices. Well, you can go to Linux, but that's a whole different breed. Right. And it's taking something to put it on and doing it, which we advise for folks. But
sure.
Yeah, we're changing ways. And I remember, you know, talking, you know, 20 years ago when we get that first big box and it weighed a ton and had twin disk drives in it. And, oh, all this.
You had two disk drives?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, at work we had twin disk drives so you could load the operating system in one and then put Lotus 1-2-3 on the other. And then the monochrome screen.
Exactly right.
If kids saw that today.
Right. They'd laugh. We were thrilled to get it.
How did you do it? Well, like I say, my first computer was a trash 80 with an 8-inch floppy.
Right.
A lot of the computers we sold were into graphic departments. Right. And so they'd get a 13-inch color monitor because that was $1,000.
Yeah, it was.
But then they got a 19-inch black and white monitor, not grayscale, black and white monitor, right. Because that was $1,000 because they wanted big and they wanted color.
Right.
And if you wanted a big color monitor, that was $5,000.
Right. It's cheaper to buy two other monitors.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But those were, the world has changed. When we went from desktops to laptops, people jumped on it because they understood the benefit of a laptop.
Although in the early days, they were rather underpowered. So
right. You
used to talk too about your store. You'd sell two computers, the laptop for mobile and the desktop for power.
Right.
And then as soon as the laptops got powerful enough, we lost a lot of sales.
You lost a lot of sales, but now stopped buying desktops again because people are buying a desktop and a Chromebook.
You're right.
Because it's the same idea. I don't need all my power when I go out. And I certainly don't need to be carrying around my entire life where somebody could steal it or I could lose it. But I could have everything I need on the Chromebook. And if I need power or extra storage or whatever, that I've got that at home.
I've seen folks, though, not even going to a desktop unit. They're still using the Chromebook. They hook it up to an external monitor, and then they've got a small 3.5-inch terabyte hard drive hooked up to it to do all the storing because they're using Google Chrome and storing everything up on the net.
Right.
They don't have to worry about it.
When I bought my desktop, I bought big. But I don't use most of it anymore because I do everything in Google Docs.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a whole different world. All right, we should probably talk about it, Jason, at some point, but let's instead right now go to the phones. Fred from Henrietta. Hi, Fred, what's up?
Hi, Nick. I'm a long-time listener, first time calling in.
Thank you for being so patient. Thank you for being so patient.
Well, I listen to the show anyway, so it's not a big deal. I got to say the audio coming through the phone is really good.
Oh, good.
Last week you had a caller who called in about having to run or wanting to run Windows XP or an older program that didn't run in Windows 10. And I've been doing that for years. I just wanted to give two other suggestions on how to do that. I've got a multi-boot computer where I've got one hard drive set up for XP, another one set up for Windows 10, and another one set up for Linux Mint. But when I boot up in the morning, I decide what I want to write, what I want to run that day, and I have old programs that'll only run in XP.
Yep. Yep, that makes sense. A lot of people are still doing that. Some of them do it with multiple boot. Some of them with bigger machines do it with virtual machines, but yeah, absolutely. You're right. That's one of the ways that people are keeping XP alive.
Now, I realize that if you're running XP, you don't want to be on the internet, so when I boot up in there, I disable the NIC card, so it's relatively safe. I don't do a lot in XP, but I also have one program I have to run in DOS, so I have to boot up on a thumb drive, and I'm running DOS.
Nice.
What are you still running in DOS?
I've got an old CAD program that talks to a plotter.
Yep.
And it's a really nice program, but I can't seem to find decent drivers for that plotter that'll work on XP or anything higher than that. And I still have the DOS thing, and it's like if it works, it works.
That's right. That's exactly right. As long as it does what, and that's the thing. We still have devices that we want to use that are perfectly alive and fine, and we can't find drivers for the newer operating systems.
And
I get that.
And 10-to-1 odds that plotter works off a serial port.
Well, yeah. My computer actually has a 3.5-inch floppy on it. It has a parallel port. It has a serial port on it.
Mm-hmm.
But it also runs Windows 10 and Linux Mint.
There you go. Good for you. Thanks, Fred. That's good information. We have to remember that people are still legitimately, not just, I hate everything new, so I'm still running XP. Yeah, you have a legitimate reason to continue to run older products, and I get that. And you found a solution, and that's really nice.
Especially for the commercial plotters, some of the commercial printers, where it might be, 10 or 20 grand to replace that thing. Where if I can, get a, flash drive and put DOS on it, all right, I saved 20 grand.
That's exactly
especially because
right.
20, 30 years ago, those things were built to last, and they're still running 20, 30 years later.
Hey, Fred.
You buy a $99 printer, it'll break in a month.
That's right.
Because I haven't played around, done this in a while. But it used to be, and I know you could in Windows 7, you could right-click on, say you got a particular program, CAD program, and you can put it on your desktop, say, for Windows 7, and it used to work on XP. Used to, and I don't know if you can do this still with Windows 10, you used to be able to right-click on it and go down to compatibility mode and select.
I think that's only in Windows 10 Pro.
Well, he's talking about in Windows 7, but the problem is not the compatibility mode. The problem is the drivers. If the drivers themselves don't work in 7 or 10,
that's true.
Then it doesn't matter how compatible the software itself is.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
It's not going to talk to it.
No, you're right, Fred. That's a good solution.
Yeah, pretty cool.
I have one other solution for the guy, and this is something that I had to do back in one of the jobs I had. We were moving from Windows 95 to Windows XP, and we had an old program that we'd custom made, and it would only run in 95, so they just plopped the XP computer down next to the other tower, and we used a KVM switch, And we just had to use the old machine when we were running the old program, and then we just switch over to the other one and do everything else.
Right. KVM stands for Keyboard Video Monitor. It's a switch that lets you hook two computers up to a single keyboard, mouse, and a video card, keyboard video mouse, not keyboard video monitor. And you would switch between them. So if you clicked it one way, you were using the same keyboard, mouse, and monitor, but you were on one machine. If you clicked it the other way, you were on the other machine. It's kind of the opposite of virtual machines inside one box. Yeah,
I still got a switch.
I had one that had four ports, and I was angry because I needed five.
So then you put two of them together, and then you have to do, you know, A gets four, and B gets four, and C gets four.
Well, I still have one down on my test bench because we'd have the one monitor that we're looking at and working on that machine. But if I had to switch up to the test bench, I just had to hit a button, and all of a sudden, boom, I'm up there, and it's showing up on the screen. Yep. So it gave you great flexibility.
Yep. I remember KVM switches very fondly. Wow. Thanks, Fred.
Yeah.
Yeah, so those are two options for people that still have to run the older stuff. The last thing I wanted to say was it's great you guys have been on for almost 30 years now. Keep it up, and I can't wait for Greenlight to come to this neighborhood.
There you go. Make sure you keep watching. Keep watching the skies. They'll get to you sooner or later.
Jeez.
Thanks, Fred.
Take it easy, guys.
You too. Bye-bye. Along that line, we got an email from our friend Jason from Altoona, PA, and he talked about last week. He was talking about AWS, the Amazon Web Services, and it's actually he was doing that, and he's, you know, you can pay anywhere from $7 a month and up to have an instance online, plus, you know, anywhere between 10 cents and up an hour when you're actually running it. So you can look at the various prices. That's called Workspaces now. So it's Amazon, aws.amazon.com/workspaces. And there is a free option, but it doesn't, you don't get to see the free option until you are actually setting things up. There you go. And setup is not that easy, but it does work. And he's using it for Fusion 360. Thanks, Jason. I know you're not actually listening today because you actually apparently are working for a living. Yeah, good for you. Somebody's got to. I mean,
yeah, he was saying in there, you know, it's just gonna. You just can't throw it in, boom, get it up and running. You got to do a little time and spend in and get in and setting it all up. It's not as quick and dirty as most systems.
Right, right. It's right. You got to have a little bit of
patience
and a little bit of knowledge and a little bit of everything else. But you can do pretty much anything you want, and they've priced it to be fairly useful. You pick the number of CPUs, the amount of memory, and it's, you know, $7.25 a month and up, and 17 cents an hour and up, and it's pretty cool. It's a pretty cool option for stuff that you. That you need to run without a lot of hassle and hardware costs. We're going to take a quick break. Back in just a couple of minutes with Dave Enright, Steve Ray, Meenik, Francesco, and you. It's 29 minutes after the hour. It's Soundbites. It's member-supported Jazz 90.1.
It's America's longest-running computer show. Back to more Soundbites with Nick, Dave, and Steve. Next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Van Wright.
And I'm Steve Wright.
And at 35 minutes after the hour, we are Soundbites. And, of course, you can give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free, 1-800-790-0415. The prices for, it's one of those weeks, the prices for James Bond-style hacks keep growing, especially for those that hijack iPhones and secure messaging apps. It's the latest sign that governments and police forces around the world are as eager as ever to exploit software that's become more difficult to compromise. On Monday, market-leading exploit broker Zerodium said it would pay up to $2 million for zero-click jailbreaks of Apple's iOS, $1.5 million for one-click iOS jailbreaks, and $1 million for exploits that take over secure messaging apps WhatsApp and iMessage. The new steeper prices indicate not only that the demand for these exploits continues to grow, but also that reliably compromising these targets is becoming increasingly hard. The big factor, however, is that there is now a higher demand for exploits. A lot of times, buyers don't want to share exploits. They want exclusive access. If there are now more buyers, it means more demand, and the price will go up. It's a good time to be a bug hunter or exploit developer, and it should continue to be a wake-up call for companies to realize that having a comprehensive bug bounty program is a must. The types of exploits sought by Zerodium are those that reliably compromise the targeted device or app without any indication to their users. That's the zero-click type. Police and nation-sponsored spies around the world rely on these types of attacks to intercept messages from criminals, terrorists, and other targets and to monitor their whereabouts and online activities in real time. Monday's updated list also doubled the price for attacks that exploit messages apps WhatsApp and iMessage. Interestingly, exploits for Signal, an encrypted messaging app that's considered the gold standard by many technologists, journalists, and lawyers, remained at $500,000, the same price as before. The relatively larger user base for WhatsApp and iMessage are likely driving the price differences announced Monday. Zerodium also has said that it sells the exploits not only to lawful government, that it sells the exploits only to lawful governments, but it has never provided details to verify those claims. It has been one of the top brokers for exploits since it made its debut in 2015, with a pledge of $1 million for reliable iOS exploits and a large number of other platform and apps. Since then, Zerodium has steadily increased those amounts. There's no reason to doubt Zerodium is making a good living paying those sums. So are you still feeling secure about your phone, your computer, your smart speaker, your car, your watch, and everything else? Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 1-800-790-0415.
One of the problems this is causing in the security industry is that legitimate security researchers are now sort of at a crossroads where, you know, I make, you know, $30,000 a year at my salary, or if finding this bug, or I can make $2 million selling it to the bad guys. Yeah. I guess we'll fund our lab for another 10 years.
Yeah, exactly. money talks. Let's be honest, money talks. And, you know, the guy, the Zerodium, whoever he, she, or they are, said that they're only selling to legit places. But, of course, we have only their word for that. And yeah, there's a pwn to own every year and things like that. But if I can make, you know, $50,000 from them or $2 million from Zerodium, I know which way I'm going to go.
Yep.
So yeah, it's very tough at this point for the legit researchers to get legit work done.
And one of the problems is there's no incentive for a company to do good security work. Because whenever there's a problem, you apologize.
And you move on.
Yeah. So there's no danger. So Google put out an interesting blog post a little bit ago. David Thacker, VP of Product Management for G Suite. I'm sorry, that was the wrong one. There's four ways bugs get found. A company finds them themselves.
Right.
Which is rare.
Yeah.
Because you're rushing to get the product working. You need to have a completely separate team of programmers that are trying to break the product. Because when you write code, you don't see your own bugs.
You just get too focused and, you know, yeah, it seems to be working. And you get into a mindset which isn't the user mindset.
And let's face it, sales is a profit center. Bug fixing is a cost center.
Yeah.
Right.
Yep.
And then you'll have the gray hat, well, the white hat researchers that will find it and responsibly disclose it so it can get fixed before it goes public. And then there is the gray hats that have been coming out recently, where there's been a bunch of people just releasing a zero day on Twitter because they're fed up. Right. And then suddenly there's a zero day, which means that there's a vulnerability known and there is no patch for it. So the bad guys have until the good guys write the patch to exploit the bug. And then there's the bad guys that find the bugs and don't tell anybody so they can exploit them. And I'm not sure where I stick the government in that list.
Right.
Because there's government agencies that find bugs to exploit them for at least hopefully for legitimate purposes.
Right.
So there's no incentive for a company to do anything about security. Mm-hmm. And so until people start demanding security in the products, there isn't going to be any incentive. And we're at that place where your credit card gets breached. Oh, well, it happens every week. The bank will send me a new credit card. But if you get problems with money taken out of your accounts or credit histories and now you can't buy that new car, it's a big hassle to those individual people.
Well, look at how far they've gone now. Credit cards. If you misplace your card, you can quick go online and turn it off yourself.
Right. So most of the credit agencies, well, I think all three of the big credit agencies allow you to do it, but they were charging a fee to turn your credit on and off. So if you're an older person who isn't going to get a new credit card or buy a new house or buy a new car anytime soon, you should freeze all of your credit histories. So no one, bad guy or good guy, can access your credit history. But for someone younger who moving into a new apartment, you got to pass a credit check. You know, you're getting a new cell phone, you got to pass a credit check. It's hard to do that. So we're seeing some customers are coming, some people are coming up with new ways to do single use credit cards. I've been reading about a company that that issues a single company credit card. So it's a credit card number tied to your bank account. That's where I don't like it. It's tied to your bank account,
right?
And you lock it to a merchant. So it's like having 100 credit cards yourself, one credit card for Amazon, one credit card for PayPal, one credit card for this company.
Louise.
But it's your one account and you generate these credit card numbers for all these other companies. And it's locked to that company. So if someone steals the credit card number that...
Can you also set the limits?
Yes, you can set your limits. Mm-hmm. You can set your daily limit. You can adjust it on the fly. One of the commercials I heard about it, someone tried to buy a computer and they had a $2,000 limit on their card, so it was denied. Oh, hang on a minute. He went into his app, raised it to $2,500. It went through, and then he lowered it back down.
Yep.
So you can do that real time on the fly? Yep, can do that now. And so there's really interesting tools that are coming out now for people. But for the general public, the Marriott breach, well, it wasn't Marriott. It was a company they bought 4 years ago, had a breach 4 years before that and that they didn't tell anybody about. So there's another 500,000 people that their account credentials were lost.
Yeah.
And there's no legal ramifications. Some people will try to form a class action suit, but you can't prove damages. That's the problem.
Yeah.
If your identity was stolen, there's no way to prove it was because of the data that was leaked by this breach.
Right.
Yep. And so there's no incentive for companies to put any effort into security.
Well, I can remember back when we had the business going, literally, I had one credit card, and I had a $500 limit,
yep.
And that's all we wanted on it. They tried raising it a couple of, we're going to help you out and raise them. I says, you do, and I'll cancel the card. I says, I don't want anything more. $500 limit. I didn't want anybody, getting a hold of it, stealing or anything else, because we were just simply buying parts. Didn't need it.
Right.
And at least 2 to 3 times, they tried doing that to me, and I had to get on the phone and do battle with them.
Yep.
It's like, seriously?
The report that we're talking about on Security Now, when the bad guys find your bugs, that means you're outsourcing your security department to the criminals.
Yeah.
I thought that was an interesting way to put it. You're outsourcing your security.
Yeah.
Yep. And the criminals are finding it before the good guys.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
All right, we should get back to the phones. Pat's been waiting patiently in Batavia, New York. Hi, Pat. What's up?
Well, guys, I enjoy your conversation, but my topic is a little different. This is for Steve. I'm wondering if you are still using the OBS and Google Hangouts to put the show on YouTube.
I am using OBS, but I'm not using Hangouts anymore. I've just got multiple cameras now feeding into OBS. So Google Hangouts...
You should tell them what OBS is.
Yeah, originally, we were using Google Hangouts because it runs on every person's computer who is in the Hangout, basically a group chat, and you can grab the video from each of those people, which was handy. And then one person would then, or in more cases than not, everyone would record their own, and then you merge them together and post, and that was a lot of work. But Google has been a little weird on what's happening with Hangouts.
Yeah, that was why I was calling, because I've heard that, they're going to be phasing out one of them by the end of 2019, and then there's other options. So I was just kind of curious where you stood with this.
Yeah, so right now I'm using OBS, which is the Open Broadcast System. It's an open source multi-camera broadcaster. So one computer becomes the video production source, basically, and you have multiple cameras. We can do it here in the studio because we're all in the same room. And I just have cameras pointed at each of us, although Dave keeps moving back and forth. And and then so that feeds directly into YouTube. So YouTube accepts the stream itself. Now, YouTube is starting to have their own streaming recorders, which is it's basically a plugin for Chrome. Not a plugin, but a function that works inside of Chrome. They don't have it in Safari yet. But for a lot of people that are doing multiple separated people, you know, like a podcast where you have people all over the country or world even, it seems to be that Skype is the most common answer for that, and doing a group chat inside Skype. And then either having each person record their own or one person record the whole thing together. So if you're in separate areas, it's getting to be tricky. I have seen a couple of people are starting to look at group FaceTime, which now offers up to 30 individual connections. But FaceTime is an Apple-only technology where Skype runs on pretty much every platform. So that's sort of where...
As does YouTube,
Right, yeah, that's sort of how it's become sort of the position it's at because it runs on anything.
Right.
Yeah, we've been looking at Zoom bringing people in different locations together so they can all see what's going on. But I always like to know what the other options are, and certainly the free ones.
Right, yeah, that's one of the things that I looked at Zoom and GoToMeeting and some of the other ones like that. And they're free for the attendees, but it's basically pay for everything else. And even with Zoom, you have one person in it hosting, and you can have 100 people watching for free. Which would be fine here, but if you want to have several people hosting it, then you start adding up into that pay tier.
Well, if you have more than two people, it limits 40 minutes for the free one.
Right.
Yeah.
So if you've got a third person, you can only go 40 minutes. If you go two, it's unlimited.
Right. But in our case, we don't know that it would only ever be two.
Oh, no, you would hope it wouldn't be two.
Right, I mean, right.
Otherwise, with that, you could just stay home and talk to them on the telephone. It was only two people talking.
Right. Yeah.
So, yeah, what Steve found is a pretty amazing little product, and it works quite well.
And it's got all sorts of fancy features for transitioning between your cameras. So if we had a dedicated video person here, we would have three cameras, one on each of us. In fact, I have a three panel set up here that doesn't work well because we don't have three cameras pointed at everyone. But you can easily switch between full screen and split screen and multi panel and you get little fades back and forth. And
you can share screen too, then, right?
Not exactly. It's feeding in from USB cameras, but I can also grab another window on the computer or another program on the computer, so I can feed its window, which we do in our Apple Cider meetings. We feed the web page we're looking at into the stream.
Yeah, I noticed you do that in the Apple Cider, but you don't do it on this.
Right. We don't generally show a screenshot here.
And when we talk about a website, I usually post the links, so it's easier to look at it up on your own.
And the reality is there's only three of us in this booth here, and so we're all fairly busy.
No, I understand.
Doing other stuff,
definitely.
But for everybody else, OBS is
the talk. Yeah.
Thanks, Pat. For everybody else, OBS is the Open Broadcaster Software, and it's at obsproject.com.
It takes a little time to set up, but once you do, it's pretty easy to use. And I haven't done it for a while because I started doing Zoom, but I think now I'm going to go back and look at the OBS again and look at this direct-to-YouTube broadcasting. So thank you very much for the update. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And I'll continue to listen.
All right. Have fun, Pat. Thanks.
And I just lost my timestamp.
You just lost your what?
The timestamp in the video just disappeared.
Well, you were playing around with it. What do you expect?
Well, guys, so before the show, the timestamp was itty bitty teeny, so I made it bigger to so you could see it. And then somewhere along the way, it jumped to giant, and now you can't see it at all. I think it's when I switched panels because I don't have that one on my my three panel shot. And so then if I point that one to no, that one's Dave. Middle one's Dave. Then I got to bring Nick up over here. But so I usually do, you know, the one camera pointed at two of us and the second camera at Dave.
Well, you can point both at you.
Yeah. No, you get to be part of this. People love to see your face. We don't know why.
Me neither. That's what I'm saying. You turn know, it to the other
there,
way.
There is a thing called masochism, and so there are people who like this, and there's the top of Dave's head.
Yeah, that's always the interesting bit, because he answers the phone. He's got to lean down to the phone, then he talks at the mic, and then he moves to the
maybe
board.
Maybe we can get him a headset with the camera pointing at him like they do for motion capture stuff, and then no matter where
we can
goes,
put green dots all over him, and he can wear the unitard.
Perfect. No unitard.
That's a big no.
That's a big no right there from me, too. All right, back. We've got just a couple of minutes. Back to the phone. Our next girl is Walt from Greece, New York. Hi, Walt. What's up?
Hi there, Nick and gentlemen. I've been catching on and off about the guy with the XP software problem.
Yeah.
And well, I run on Linux. I use a Linux machine. I've had very good success with Wine.
Yep. Wine is an acronym that means Wine is a recursive acronym.
Yeah.
It means Wine is not an emulator. And it is an emulator that emulates Windows inside of Linux, and it does everything from very old versions to fairly modern versions. So yeah, it might be an alternative. But again, Steve's problem is not running the software; it's having a driver.
Oh, okay.
Right. So that's his problem, but. For pretty much everything else, then yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I just have one other question to you. Do you ever read DistroWatch?
Oh, yes.
Okay, what did you think about the fellow's 2019 or review of 2018 when he said what he prefers for other software, I mean operating systems, you know, between Manjaro and Ubuntu, et cetera. Do you have any comments?
I am still an Ubuntu guy, although I've been looking at quite a number of others. My list of virtual machines is now takes me a minute and a half to scroll through, and I've been playing with several others. But so far, I'm still an Ubuntu guy, and it's mainly because it's one of the first ones I started with. And I understand it deeply, but there's a bunch of really good ones out there, and I certainly have listed all the ones that were in that list of his, and I intend to check each one of them out. Honestly, that's from the opinion. What section is that? And I got it bookmarked on my other machine, of course. So. But yeah, the point here that we're making is there's a thing called DistroWatch, distrowatch.com, distro short for distribution of a computer, and it talks about all of the various Linux programs and a bunch of other stuff like DuckDuckGo and a bunch of others, They talk about each of them and what the newest release is and what it does and all of that other stuff, I'm a big fan of looking at their website quite regularly to see what all the latest are. They just had a new release of CloneZilla, and I find myself downloading most of them and playing with them at the very least.
Yeah, I too do that quite a bit, and I've developed my own favorite. I still like Ubuntu, but I have also another favorite, but I won't go into it. You know, I don't want to taint anybody's idea of what they should be turning to. But Linux is just fantastic. It's free. It's stable. It runs well. I love it.
Yeah, I've been using it for 20 years, and I haven't missed Windows one day, not one single day. But I guess it depends on what it is you do and how you do it. If you are running a program that only runs in Windows, of course, you need Windows.
Although in most cases, you can find an alternative to run on other OSs.
Right, right.
And that can often be an issue when you're switching computers, even switching your own OS. You're used to Windows 7, and now you're getting Windows 10. Your old Windows 7 app may not work. So instead of paying a fortune for the new Windows 10 version, maybe look at some of the cheaper, if not free, alternatives.
Right, and there's a site called alternative2.net, alternative2.net, and you type in a program name, and it shows you all the alternatives. And some of them are, but do a little bit of research, and you'll certainly find a good one somewhere along the line. That's some good advice there.
All right.
Thanks a lot, Walt.
Thank you very much for listening to me, and I appreciate your input, too. Thanks.
Thank you, Walt.
Welcome.
Yeah, there are a lot of free operating systems. Some of them work very much like Windows, so you don't have to learn a whole lot of new stuff. Some of them work very much like the Mac, so you don't have to learn a whole lot of new stuff. But Linux is, of course, free. All of the programs, most of the programs in it are free. And I got tired of paying the Microsoft tax a couple of decades ago, and I haven't missed it. I haven't looked back, and I haven't needed anything under Windows for a very, very, very long time. In particular, by sticking it in a VM, I was able to learn without in my case, it was a separate computer. I had an old machine, but sticking it in a VM or on an old laptop or whatever gives you the opportunity to play and to really have a nice opportunity to learn a new operating system. And after all, for me at least, that's fun. That's the fun part of computing.
And that's DistroWatch's slogan. Put the fun back in computing. Use Linux.
That's right. And it's very cool to discover all the things you can do. And there's still 20 years later, there's still a certain joy in saying, wait, and that's free? You find a cool new program that does exactly what you need to do, and you think, and that's free?
Yep.
Like Open Broadcast Software, the Open Broadcaster software, the OBS that Steve is using, that's mm-hmm. free.
I was looking at it. There's a commercial program called Wirecast that is very similar, but for what we wanted to do, it would be like $1,000.
Right. Maybe not.
Maybe for a small company or a bigger business, but yeah, not for a small nonprofit.
Yeah, Rob's not going to go there.
Yeah. And so what was interesting is being able to see what you can get in the free and open source community that does 99% of what we needed to do. In fact, it does a lot more than I needed to do.
Right. It's way more than 100% of what you need to do.
Yeah.
And that's what we find with Linux. People talk a lot about, it doesn't do everything for me. I bet it does. You just have to figure out how it does it slightly differently. Anyway, we're done for the first hour. We'll be back, though. So, take your little bio break, but come back because we'll be back with Dave Enright, with Steve Ray, with me, Nick Francesco, and you. It's 59 minutes after the hour. You continue to listen to the longest-running computer show in the known universe. That's right. I don't know what you thought you were doing, but right now you're listening to Sound Bites right here on the Truly Great. And truly grateful to you that we can indeed continue to be member supported with your generosity. Jazz 90.1. Stay tuned. We will see you on the other side.
Computer talk you can understand. More Sound Bites is next on member supported Jazz 90.1.
WGMC Greece Rochester. A public service of the Greece Central School District, Jazz 90.1.
On Instagram at WGMC Jazz 901.
Welcome back to America's longest running computer show, Soundbites, on member supported Jazz 90.1. Get online now. Call 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 800-790-0415. Or submit your question by email at soundbites.org. Once again, here's Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray on member supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 5 minutes after the hour, you're hurtling headlong into the second hour of the longest-running computer show in the known universe. That's right. I don't know what you thought you were going to be doing, but right now you're listening to Sound Bites right here on Jazz 90.1.
Had to think, huh?
Had to think for a minute. Where are we? And we're going to go to the phones. Our next caller is Nick from right here in the studio. No, 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 from Batavia, New York.
That's you.
Hi, Nick. What's up?
Hey, is Saturday a good time to make a donation to support the show?
Always a good time to make a donation. Just go to the website, jazz901.org, click on the Donate Now button, and if you scroll down, you'll see the some soundbite stuff, and you can put in your own amount of money or whatever, however you want to do that. And there's a soundbites only section at the bottom. They put us, of course, at the bottom.
The best always comes last.
The best always comes last, and they know that our listeners know enough to scroll.
Yeah.
Well, I saw that, but I wasn't sure I could specify the show.
Yes, you can.
Oh, yeah, if you go down toward the bottom of that list, you'll see a soundbites only section. They seem to have...
And there's also a notes field.
Yeah, and there's a notes field.
Yeah. I do have a question, though.
Yes, please ask. But thank you for that, and everybody should know, before we get to Nick's question, everybody should know that you can donate 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. You can make it your hobby.
365 days out of the
year. Exactly.
Even Christmas and New Year's.
Exactly. All right, sorry, Nick, go ahead.
Okay. I'd like to make an older computer Wi-Fi. Okay?
Sure.
And... it would be wonderful if it had a box that went from Wi-Fi to Ethernet, you know what I mean, and went into, could use it on other computers besides this one.
Most of them are USB, USB to Wi-Fi.
Does the older computer have a USB in it?
Yes.
Yeah. Then there are devices you can buy that you just plug in, and theoretically, if it's a decent version of Windows, it'll figure it out, and suddenly, bang, Wi-Fi exists. There will be, I don't know of a multiple-use device, but there are other devices that you plug into USB, and they connect to a wired connection, a regular Ethernet connection. I actually have one of those for my Chromebook. It's just a little cable with a USB at one end and Wi-Fi at the other, with Ethernet at the other, and the Chromebook has a driver for it and just works.
Nope. Now there's different styles of USB to Wi-Fi. There's some of them that are just a little nub, it kind of looks like one of those little mouse RF dongles. And I never really liked, they're the cheapest one, like $20, but I've never really liked them because they can't have a very big antenna. So if you never get more than 10 or 20 feet from your base station, that'd be fine. But then there's bigger ones that actually have bigger antennas on them so that it can pick up a signal farther away.
No, is there confusion if it has an Ethernet card in it?
No, you set the you would set the priority in your network settings as to which connection is being made. So if there's no wire plugged in, then the Ethernet won't have an IP address, and it will use the Wi-Fi IP address. And Nick just found one with an antenna for $20. That's pretty good.
Yeah.
Okay. 1.2 gigabits.
You can find them. What I did was I just did a Google search for USB to Wi-Fi, and the very first thing that came up was an Amazon link, and there were a half a dozen at the top, and one of them is actually just it's essentially a USB adapter with an antenna on it, is what it looks like. A right angle antenna, so it stands up. It does 2.4 gig, 5.8 gig, 1.2 megabits per second, 5 decibels, and it's full Wi-Fi. And you can find similar devices that are USB to Ethernet. Now, of course, if you're using that, you're using two different ports or switching them back and forth. But as Steve said, the computer doesn't get confused. It looks to both, and if it finds only one and that has a legit IP address, then it just uses that. So you could be on Wi-Fi 1 minute and Ethernet the next minute, and it's fine.
And most of the modern OSs, too, can use both at the same time.
Right.
So your local network can be Ethernet. To get to your printer, and then you use Wi-Fi to get to the internet,
okay,
if you want to.
Yeah. So it's a gift, so I'm trying to do it right.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Bye. Bye then.
And by the way, that's a really kind of wonderful thing to do. If you've got an older machine that you aren't using anymore, gifting it to someone is probably a way cool way to continue the to let that thing have a life. You know, my daughter is home for Christmas. We pushed it forward into the year. She's already eyeing a couple of my Chromebooks. So I think,
like I told you, you created a monster.
I did. I've created a monster. I've created a tech monster.
She's a mini Nick.
She is. She's.
I had to laugh at that. You know, it's funny how our kids,
do that.
You know, you think,
I'm almost a little disappointed. So my wife and I were both real big science fiction geeks.
Right.
I was more into computers than she was. My son is neither. I mean, he didn't get it from either of us. He's a car geek.
What?
So he's turning into a mechanic. He wants to work on airplanes, so I'll give him that. But he's starting out with cars because they're cheaper to.
And you can get them.
And you can find a lot more jobs working on cars.
Yeah, right.
But I know it didn't work out at all. You know, I played good rock and roll for him. You know, we watched science fiction all the time. He's into EDM and cars.
Unbelievable.
Of course, he's only 20, so there's still time.
Damn kids. Yeah, no, I get it. It's that's very funny. Kids are who they are, and they're going to do what they're going to do, and there's not much you can do about that.
Yeah.
All right, let's take. This was actually one of my favorite stories this week. Windows 10, next feature upgrade, will commandeer 7 gigabytes of your personal computer's storage space to better ensure updates are properly processed, Microsoft announced on Monday. The drive space, dubbed reserved storage, will set aside, starting with what Microsoft will likely name Windows 10 April 2019 update and mark as 1903 in its four-character year-month label, 1903 or 1904. The feature upgrade may begin distribution in March or April. Our goal is to improve the day-to-day functions of your PC by ensuring critical OS functions always have access to disk space. Says Jesse Rawan. I don't know. He's a program manager in the Storage and File Systems Group. Although Rawan touched on several tasks for which reserved storage would prove useful, he highlighted its duties during an update upgrade because of Microsoft's habits of using update as an all-inclusive term that also covers upgrade. He only implied that the set-aside speed was necessary for the two feature upgrades Windows 10 deserves annually. So 7 gigabytes of your disk storage will be set aside by Microsoft to use twice a year. Nice of them.
So they still haven't gotten the 1809 update working properly, and we're already talking with, they're calling it 19H1 because they haven't decided what month they're going to put it out yet.
Right. And they're already saying yes. And the old one, by the way, if you're still running Windows 7 and you downloaded that update, it may well have killed your internet connection, and good luck getting it back. The compressed files will be downloaded on your machine, and they comprising either an update or an upgrade. They need drive space to unpack, right? Because they come as compressed files. Updates and upgrades also build temporary files as the process runs. Ideally, such files are deleted after they've served their purpose. Reserve space is not used to hold the previous iteration of Windows 10, which is stored so that users can roll back the system during the first 30 days. That's even more space. According to Rawan, reserved storage will be implemented by default in all PCs with 1903 and later factory pre-installed or on machines where 1903 and later were clean installed, such as during a re-image by IT. It was unclear whether Microsoft would requisition the space on PCs upgraded to 1903 from an earlier version, or would do so later, perhaps during a 1903 to 1909 upgrade late in 2019. Other questions remained unanswered as well, including whether the company administrators would be able to manage reserve storage via group policies. Reserve storage is at its most basic way for Microsoft to guarantee there is sufficient disk space to process and complete a feature upgrade, although software tradition has been to simply let the user tell the user how much space is required, and Microsoft wants to remove the user from the equation because users are sloppy, and doing it all electronically is much, much nicer. In that way, reserve storage is simply another example of how Microsoft has tried to automate updates and upgrades to secure their success or as high a rate of success as possible within a hardware-software environment that seems infinitely inconstant. With moves like cumulative updates, Microsoft has aggressively removed variables that stand in the way of upgrade update victories. This forced caching of disk space is in the same vein. It's also part of a resource appropriation pattern Microsoft has crafted with Windows. For example, the company's mandated diagnostic data collection from the OS, where in the past it was strictly opt-in and has taken bandwidth from some users to better serve updates and upgrade to others. In the past, such behavior by Microsoft has met with resistance, to put it as mildly as possible. So, how much free space is on your hard drive? Better be a minimum of 7 gig. Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. It's 966-5299, toll-free 1-800-790-0415. Just another example of why we shouldn't call them personal computers.
Yeah.
Because let's face it, Microsoft owns them, not you.
And yeah. 7 gigs isn't much if you have, you know, a terabyte or 2 terabyte spinning drive.
Right.
But a lot of devices now are 64 gig, 128 gig solid state drives.
32 gig.
32, and that's a lot of space.
That's a significant portion of your space. It's a quarter of it.
Hey, Mark. Yep.
It's Microsoft. Well, and I understand the problem. Microsoft is probably a little tired of people constantly complaining that their upgrade died or didn't work or whatever, and they're doing what they can to make sure that it at the very least it's got whatever you need. But the reality is that you don't have control over your own machine. Microsoft does,
and they're really trying to push the updates to you. Apple started doing the same thing. Although they touted as great new features, you should really install Mojave. In fact, I was doing a machine this week. So 10.14 is the current system version.
Sure.
We had a customer that brought a machine in that was running 10.6. So what was that? 8, 10 years old. He hasn't upgraded. So we did a first upgrade to 10.9 because he's running old software. He doesn't want to learn something new.
Right.
That was the earlier discussion here. Don't learn anything new. And so we're running 10.9, and then when I check for updates, it's trying to sneak the 10.13 upgrade
sure.
in as an update.
Yep.
No, that's a major, major change. And we always warn people, Windows and Mac, don't do the major upgrades for a while. Let someone else find the problems.
Somebody else be the experiment.
Check your programs to make sure they're compatible. But when they're now sneaking in, so Microsoft is calling it feature updates, but in the olden days, that would have been an upgrade to another point release.
Right.
And Apple is doing the same thing with their annual up. At least you know, we know it comes out in the fall. There's an upgrade every fall from Apple. Don't get tricked into installing those. Especially we're seeing 10.14 on older machines is really slowing down.
Right.
Which is unusual because the iOS 12 on older phones really sped things up. And so, oh yeah, we can run a new OS on an old machine and it feels better.
Not
in the computers.
Anymore. Yeah. Right. And this is just one more step to Microsoft saying, we're going to just rent you Windows.
Yeah.
Yep. You know, once they make it so that the system is as nearly foolproof as you can make it. Of course, who was it who said, as soon as you make something foolproof, God makes a better fool.
Mm-hmm.
But the point is, they're going to make it as foolproof as possible. And once they do that, now they can start renting you the operating system on a yearly basis instead of selling it to you.
And they're
going to
have you sucked into that and committed more and more to that OS.
Yep.
Because of the longevity, you know, well, you've had it this long.
Yep.
And they always say it's so you get the latest features and fixes. Okay, fixes I may not mind, but I'm still trying to learn the old features. Don't give me new ones yet.
Right.
And some of the features are, do you really need them?
Yeah.
Well, and that's why Chromebooks have become so popular. People realize they can do everything they want to do on a machine that costs less, has fewer hassles, and certainly no bugs compared to Windows. So it's a whole new world, and people just need to kind of get used to it. All right, back to the phones. Our next caller is Mark from Greece, New York. Hi, Mark. What's up?
Hey, guys. I was just had some experience with updating to the latest feature update for Windows, and I find that using the update assistant is much better than just using the Windows update.
Right.
I found that when it failed on two of my machines, I used the update assistant, and it was flawless and no problems.
Yep, because, again, Update Assistant automates things a little differently and a little better. It's again, part of that step that Microsoft is making toward toward renting the operating system, and that's one way they do it. They're putting their money and their effort into Update Assistant because it's going to be the thing they'll use in the future.
Right. Like I said years ago when Ted came out and everyone's going, oh, well, eventually they're going to make us pay for it. And I go, no, we're not going to pay for 10. We're going to pay for the one that comes out after that. I said, I think we're all guinea pigs for them to basically refine their
your
their
beta testing
system. And, and then we're going to pay. And that's kind of what happened.
That's exactly what happened and what is happening. We're going to Microsoft has said time and time again they want to rent us the operating system. And that means you pay on a yearly basis. And if you stop paying, it goes away. By the way, it doesn't mean you stop at the level you're at. It means it goes away. And,
right. It stops totally. You can't use it.
Right. That's exactly right. One of the ways they're doing that, of course, is as you said, using the Update Assistant, which they're putting much more effort into than the plain Update Manager. So
that does work much better. Yeah. I hadn't had either one of those fail once I used that. It did fail in Update where it would hang at a certain percentage, whether it be 81% or whatever it was. They didn't hang on the Update Assistant.
Right, and that's mostly because, like I said, Microsoft has pretty much stopped putting effort into the regular update process and instead putting into the Update Assistant.
Yeah. Okay, guys.
Thanks, Mark. We appreciate it. So if you're having problem updating, try Update Assistant as opposed to just Update. You all right there?
Yeah.
Okay.
I was trying to talk and breathe, and apparently can't do both.
No.
And because of all these problems people have with updates, people are scared of the updates, and that's why we had a customer this week had a 10-year-old OS and couldn't run anything new.
That's exactly
people
right.
People don't want to upgrade because there's always problems.
That's exactly right. I think about, like I've said, I'm on Linux, and all I do is every once in a while a little button comes up, says an update. I click on the button, keep going back to what I was doing, and only if it's an actual operating system upgrade do I have to reboot. So I had three or four small security updates this past week, and just click, go back to what I was doing, click, go back to what I was doing. It all happens in the background, and I get a little notice that says your system is upgraded. Okay.
And rarely have to reboot.
Very rarely. Very rarely. I had a small issue with my USB drive suddenly becoming read-only. And that was some dumb thing I had done while playing with something else, of course.
It's a safety measure.
Safety measure. And I did have to redo that. I did have to reboot after that because, obviously, the little bit of code that says this is read-only is still in memory. So I had to reboot that. But other than that, I haven't rebooted in forever.
My uptime is only 19 days. Oh. So now, what happened 19 days ago that I rebooted?
All right, back to the phones. Our next caller is Andy from Greece, New York. Hi, Andy. What's up?
Hey, Nick. Quick question. On this thing where Microsoft wants to commandeer part of your hard drive space, can you control where it takes it?
Nope.
Probably from your C drive is about all you're going to be able to control. So if you have multiple drives, that's one way to do it.
Yeah, so if your C drive has less than 7... I'd say 10 gigabytes just to be safe.
Yeah.
You better free up some space before the next update.
Well, no, it's the C drive is an SSD. And the drive, the EMF, are 1 terabyte spinning drive.
I wonder if it'll come from the temp directory, which you could then assign a variable and point to the
drive. Well, that would be nice. We don't know.
We don't know.
They won't bother to tell us. But
someone will find out and post it when it happens.
Yep.
Especially if they have a small SSD as their boot drive.
Right, and that's the thing. Nowadays, people have small SSDs.
I did double my SSD drive a year ago from 125 to 250 because it just kept chewing up space.
Yep.
Right. Well, and that's what I did. I have a. Of course, I'm running Linux, so I don't really care. But I replaced my 120 gig spinning little 2.5-inch hard drive with a 250-gig SSD 2.5-inch hard drive, and my laptop boots up in 8 seconds, and
things boom, just, away you go.
First time I booted it up, I thought, oh, crap, something didn't work. Wait, everything's there.
It's already done.
I was absolutely convinced. I mean, I'm used to my Chromebook booting up in 8 seconds, but not my laptop.
Hey.
Now, of course,
when I built this computer and I put the SSD in it, I mean, I've been used to, for years, you know, my box having a spinning drive taking X amount of time to boot up. And when I put in a Samsung 125 gig, and I was absolutely amazed at how fast it booted. I mean, I was up and running on Windows in something less than 15 seconds.
Yep.
Just unheard of.
Yep.
And when I switched to 250, it didn't change anything, and it's, you know, but it gave me more space, so I didn't have to worry about running out of space with Windows gobbling up things.
Yep.
And everything else runs off the spinning drive.
Right.
So it's all programs are put onto the D drive and or the D partition, and we go from there.
Right. Of course,
Windows is arbitrarily grabbing space. If it's grabbing it out of my SSD drive, that's going to be. I mean, I can.
Well, see, Andy,
again,
there's your problem. It's not your SSD drive. It's Microsoft's SSD drive. You're just using it.
Yeah. So that's their thoughts.
I know they're a grabby house guest. What can I say?
Yeah. No, you're the house guest. It's their machine. They're making that very clear as time goes on. Just because you paid for the hardware doesn't make it your machine.
Yes. So you fool.
Linux Mint will be on the machine.
Yeah. Well, a lot of people are discovering that, and that's one of the problems that Microsoft has right now, is that in order to continue to grow their revenue stream, they're doing things that are pushing people away. It's the nature of the beast. They aren't making money if you don't upgrade to the latest and greatest immediately and instantly. And so by renting you the operating system instead of selling it, they have a steady income stream, and they can do what they want to assure that they have an easy time keeping your machine running the way they want it to. And people are unhappy with that, and so they're buying Chromebooks, and they're buying Linux boxes, and we're seeing a slow but steady sea change to that stuff. Chromebooks are already the number one selling laptop, have been for a while. Schools are buying them in droves.
And they've been buying them for a while.
Yep. You know what the Jesuits say, give me your child before he's seven and he's mine for life. Mm-hmm. So kids who use Chromebooks, that's why Apple used to give them away to schools.
Yeah.
Kids who use Chromebooks in grammar school go on to use Chromebooks in high school, go on to use Chromebooks in adult life. And when they discover they can do everything they need to do with them, they don't look back, and that bothers Microsoft. And when Microsoft sees that a lot of the publicity they get is bad because of failed upgrades and because of everything else, they do whatever they can to make sure those things don't happen. All right, we got to take a break. Thanks, Andy. Back in just a couple of minutes, Dave Enright, Steve Ray, me, Nick Francesco, and you. It's 29 minutes after the hour. It's Soundbites. It's member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Before you call into our show, please make note of the following rules. 1. Turn your radio down. 2. Turn your radio down lower. 3. Remember, nobody has invented a good-sounding speakerphone yet. Don't use them. 4. Make sure you have a point. It makes for a more interesting show. 5. Calling does not guarantee you'll get on the air. No whining. 6. If you do get on the air, please do not tell the host what you just told the screener. We don't care. And 7. Is that radio turned down yet? We hope this will make for a more enjoyable program, and we thank you for your time.
Online 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at soundbites.org. More with Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 35 minutes after the hour, we are Soundbites, and we have Ken from Webster, New York on the line. Hiya, Ken. What's up?
Hello, gentlemen. Two things on my mind. First of all, my wife's had a Chromebook for about 2 years. And she had an issue that happened about a week ago that had never happened before. And I wanted to share that information that it might be helpful to somebody else. At the same time, I'd like to get your reaction to it.
Sure.
The problem cleared itself. I will tell you this. I could tell when she was on her Chromebook, she was getting frustrated. So I asked her, what's the problem? She says, it's locked up. I can't shut it down. The keypad doesn't work. Mouse don't work. Nothing works on it. I can't get it to work. Well, I looked at it, and not right away, I'll admit that, but I saw down in the left-hand corner, it said, looking for Exalator.com. Now, we found out what Exalator was after the fact. I couldn't get it to work. And finally, I did the old, used to be a tech that worked for JB Sound. His name was Dave. And if you couldn't fix it the traditional way, then you might even put it in a box and heat it up. And if that didn't work, you got out a hammer. Yeah. That was their psychology over there.
Right.
I actually threw mine on the floor, her Chromebook. Mm. But that didn't help.
Yeah.
But it cleared itself, and it took about a half an hour. But it's malware.
Yep.
Yeah, it's a pop-up window. And what some of the windows will do is it's called a modal window. So you can't do anything until you okay to that window. But then it will put the window off the side of the screen, so you can't see where it is. You can't get to the okay button or the close button. So it hides itself from your control,
right,
a lot of times.
It took about a half an hour for it to evaporate.
Right. But it will eventually go away. And that's, it's malware, and we've said that Chromebooks can't get malware, but what it really is a pop-up window in the browser, and there is no way to stop those. It can't damage your machine.
Just got locked up.
It just locks it off.
Until you okay the box in that window that you can't get to.
Right, or until it just dies.
It closes itself, yeah.
Okay.
So what probably happened is...
Here's my last question.
Yeah,
I'm miles and miles and miles away from you guys from the amount of information and the knowledge I have. You folks were very, very handy for years and years. Now you guys are miles above my head, but you're talking about a lot of stuff I don't need. But here's something I would like to have. I know that a Chromebook and certain applications can install Android apps if you've got a Chromebook that allows you to do that.
Right.
And I know that you can install some Windows applications.
Yeah.
The one I've had for years and years and years that I absolutely love, I've looked at other ones, but I love this one the most. I could run this program in my sleep. I like Microsoft's Digital Image Pro. I use that program almost every day of my life because I'm into photography.
Right.
Is there any way that could be installed either on my wife's Chromebook, which will take Android apps, and I also have a Chromebox?
Wow, that's that's
I'll tell you
a
what,
very
Nick,
good
I'll
question.
I'll give you $100 if you can do it.
I don't know that. You can run Office apps on the Chromebook, but I don't know about Digital Image Pro. Are
okay.
you using version 10, the newest version?
Oh, no, that's an old...
No, it's not.
I would say that...
Well, Digital Image was discontinued and replaced by Picture-It in 2006.
That's absolutely right.
Right.
Yeah.
And as a matter of fact, I had Picture-It. I think I had it on... what was before 7? No. XP. I had it on XP. But a friend of mine had it on disk, and I took that one off, and I put Digital Image Pro. I would say I've had it on for 10 years.
Yeah. I don't honestly know that, as it's not a program that I've used ever, and it doesn't even exist anymore. So there are certainly alternatives to that, but what you want is that particular...
There program. Is,
I get that.
There is a program called Crossover from a company called CodeWeaver. And it is basically a Windows emulator for Linux and Mac. And now they have a Chrome version.
Right.
So, still in beta, but better than nothing.
Right.
So you install that in Chrome, and then you can install a Windows app to run inside CodeWeaver. It's Crossover is a commercial package of wine, which is an emulator, it's not an emulator, as right. its acronym says.
Right, exactly.
Could that be installed on the Chrome box or the Chrome or Patty's Chromebook?
Yeah, anything running Chrome OS.
Chrome OS.
Right, so the Chromebook or the Chrome box.
And what's that called again, please?
Crossover.
Crossover.
From CodeWeaver.
From CodeWeaver. Write that down, Patty.
And I'll put it on our link here in a minute.
If I can make this work, I have to give you guys a real good...
You said $100 earlier.
Yeah.
Jazz901.org and the Donate Me button.
Yeah, I got you.
There you go.
And because it's more than $90.10, you'll get the membership card, right?
Yeah, that's my wife asked me. She's going to write it down one more time.
It's called Crossover.
Crossover.
And the company name is CodeWeavers.
CodeWeaver.
Steve is putting a link on our website.
Oh, good.
It'll be there in a minute and a half, so it'll be there for you.
Well, thank you very much.
All right.
I want to wish you a happy new year, and at the same time, I got a little slogan, I mean this as a compliment.
Yeah.
May the bird of paradise fly up your nose in 2019.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Okay. Appreciate that.
That's a compliment.
It is so far.
All right, guys. Bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
As long as it doesn't crap on your head.
Now. That's funny. The big thing is no new operating system is designed with ancient products in mind, quite honestly. But it's certainly not an impossibility that because it's an old product, it doesn't have any weird requirements, and so it could work.
And you could always check through the Google Play Store looking for Chrome app. There are a lot of image manipulation programs available for Chrome, and you might find one you like just as well.
Right. But it does require
a learning curve.
Right, a learning curve, exactly. All right, back to the phones. Our next caller is Gerd from Pittsford, New York. Hiya, Gerd, what's up?
Yeah, this is I'm from Victor.
Oh, sorry, Victor, sorry.
That's okay. I have an Acer Chromebook, 15-inch. And I have a little problem with up on top. I have Drudge Report, WND, ESL, Weather, Capital Confidential, and there's the Fox News thingy that when I hit it gives you a brief image, and then it's gone. Is there a conspiracy going on for right-wing stuff?
It is likely that what's happened is... let me go there. Hold on. No, you have to spell it right before you can go to it. Is it just foxnews.com?
Fox News. Breaking News. .com, I guess.
Fox News Breaking News .com?
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't think that's the right URL. The Fox News itself is just foxnews.com.
Right. Yeah, there doesn't seem to be a Fox News Breaking News.
But when I hit that...
Oh, yeah, I get a blank screen as well.
Yeah.
I don't know what's on there. I'm wondering if it's a flash.
Whoever registered that domain has nothing on it.
That is a bunch of flash code and a bunch of junk. I might suggest you just go to foxnews.com. It looks like foxnewsbreakingnews.com is a fake website.
But I've used it all along, and then all of a sudden it just showed up for a second, and then it was a blank screen.
Right. It
might be hijacked.
Right. It is possible that Fox News finally caught up with them and stopped them from using it or took it over and is making it blank.
You've scanned your machine for spyware and malware lately?
I even power washed it.
No, I'm on the site right now. All I get is a blue bar. It is clear that the site has been gone or was hacked or was something.
It's registered in Germany.
Yeah, it's not the real website.
Well, so it may be they changed something at their end recently, and that's why it stopped working.
Or but maybe, have you gone there? It might be Flash.
I mean, yeah, I do have Flash. Let me try it. I would say if you want to get to the Fox News website, just go to foxnews.com.
Right. But what we're telling you is that the foxnewsbreakingnews.com website is fake. It's out of some person in Germany who just stole the Fox News name. And I'm sorry it's not there anymore, but it has nothing to do, clearly, with real Fox News.
I got a park redirection and now a fake flash update notice. So it's malware.
It's malware. It's an entirely malware site. I'm sorry. It may have been taken over by somebody or whatever, but your best bet is to remove it from your bar and never go there again.
How do I do that?
It's up there in your bar, right?
Right.
Right-click on it. Which is on a Chromebook that's double tap, right? Tap with two fingers. And just over halfway down the list is delete.
Got it.
And if you clicked on the right thing and you hit delete, you're done.
I have three fake flash update notices coming from the same website.
Nice. They really want you to fake update.
And only one of them has the flash logo on it.
Well, one out of three ain't bad. So clearly clearly, it's a fake website, so just don't go there anymore, Gerd.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. You guys are great. I'm a member, and keep up the good work. Happy New Year.
You too. You too to all of that, and thank you for being a member. It's what keeps us on the air.
I like their URL, alwaysnew.freeflashupdate2019.xyz.
.xyz, no less. Yeah. Not bad. Not bad. Because Chrome... Google has done, and that might be, I didn't even think of this.
Yeah.
Google has started blocking fake websites automatically, and that may be what's happened. The site may still be there.
Although you usually get a message warning you this site is bad and don't go here.
Yeah. But it's clearly whoever just called in may have to call back.
Smiley, let's try this again.
Yeah, we'll see what's happening. Phone issues. But the reality is that anybody can create a website called Fox News, whatever they want to call it. And if they get people to go to it, everybody went, no, but he's still not there.
Button pushing.
Yeah. At some point, you have to be a little more careful. There is a site called... Who is at whois.com. whois.com/whois, WHOIS, whois.com/whois. And if you type in Fox News Breaking News.com, it's somebody in Germany. They've had it since, they've just
2017. It's
2017,
new.
Yeah, just a couple of years, and.
So you know, anybody can register any domain they want as long as it's not already taken, and so the bad guys will take domains that are close to real company names or misspellings of real company names, in order to trick you into going there and installing their fake software.
Yeah,
that's very, very nice. In fact, that's a good segue here. There has been a rash of fake phone calls purporting to be from Apple this week. We're getting a lot of calls from our customers that are getting these phone calls. Apple, Microsoft, Google, nobody will call you if you have a problem with your computer. They don't know, for one, and two, they're too busy doing the other things for the other. they'll never call you. Don't buy gift cards to pay for online tech support. Legitimate companies would use a regular credit card. We're hearing more and more of these fake companies want iTunes cards. Or the other day, we had a new one. They wanted the Google Play gift card.
Nice.
Some of them want a Walmart gift card. Yeah. Apple would ask you to go to Walmart and buy a gift card to pay for tech support online.
Yeah.
No. These companies will not call you. Any message you get is fake. Any email you get is suspect.
Right.
Phone calls you get are fake. The good guys can't help anymore because there's so many bad guys that you can't trust any message you get. So the good guys almost can't do anything. They can send you an email, but there's so many fake emails.
Right.
It's getting to be horrible.
Well, what I like is since I've got this Pixel phone, Google has a service you can opt into that lets you that they will, if it's a known spam caller,
mm-hmm.
they don't even bother to tell you if the call came in. And my number of calls I get every day has dropped.
Oh, mine's dropped drastically.
Yeah, yeah. All right, back to the phones. Our next caller is Smiley from Rochester, New York. Hi, Smiley, what's up?
The site is called It Still Works. It's got recommended replacements for Digital Image Pro, and it's like what you said. You buy a new car, you just got to get used to where the buttons are, and maybe one of these programs would work for him.
Right. So it's similar to the Alternative 2 website. It still works to let you find programs that still work.
Right. Perfect. Itstillworks.com?
Yeah.
Perfect.
I'll hang up and let you finish on the radio there.
Thanks, Smiley. We appreciate it. Yeah, right, it still works. That's a nice looking little website. It looks like they have some pretty good information on there.
Instructions for the Motorola walkie-talkie. Nice. In case you didn't know how to use a walkie-talkie.
Very nice. Yeah, and there's lots of, it looks like it's a combination of how to get something working and how to keep something working.
Yeah.
So that's kind of nice. You can also find YouTube videos on a lot of that sort of stuff. And, you know, how to rewire or how to fix or how to change a battery or how to, you know, do whatever it is you're going to do. And those kinds of places really have some nice value because, as we see here over and over and over again, people really don't want to give up the stuff that they know works.
Yep.
You know, they want to use what they've always used, and companies don't always want you to do that because if you've already paid for it, they're not getting new money. So by discontinuing an old item and trying to move you to a new item. That's another nice thing about Linux. I've got programs that I've been using for decades that they upgrade them. They have new features. They have new functions. But it's still the same program, and it still works in the same way because they are free to begin with, and nobody has to make money by changing things just for the sake of changing things.
What was your story about someone who complained the whole program didn't work because the button changed from green to blue?
Yes.
The whole program. It just doesn't work.
It doesn't work anymore because they change a button color, or they changed the order things were on in a menu, I had one person who was very upset that they had lost a specific program, and I said, it's right there, and they said, no, that's not it, and I realized they had changed the icon.
Yep.
And so by changing the icon, it wasn't the familiar icon anymore. The program hadn't changed a whit. Okay, it was exactly the same program.
They just changed the desktop icon.
They changed the icon, and so the person couldn't click on it. It wasn't the same program. So what I did was I went in and
changed it back.
Put the icon, copied the icon.
You were the hero.
The website and blah, blah, blah. And, yeah. But the reality is that we want what we want, and we want it the way we want it. And I get that. You certainly can't argue with that, but it is, it does make it an interesting issue. All right, listen, we're done for another week. I want to thank everybody who called in. I want to thank those who called in early. Yeah, you should do that more often. I want to thank Dave Enright and Steve Ray. I'm Nick Francesco. Don't go away. George is coming in to play the best German music you'll hear all week. Michael's here to keep him on the straight and narrow, so it's not too dangerous. And we will be back next week with a whole lot more of the longest-running computer show in the known universe. That's right. You've been listening to Soundbites right here on the Truly Great, and truly grateful to you that we can continue to be member-supported Jazz 90.1. Be good to each other. We'll see you in just 166 hours.